Hello and welcome to Cobblecast. This is Roh Jacobi. Cobblecast is a podcast brought to you by cobblenow.com, and we aim to tell Afghanistan stories to the world because Afghanistan matters and the stories of its people matter. In every episode, we will try to speak to people who've got interesting ideas, interesting stories to tell about that country and its people. And in this first episode, we thought it would be best to hear from somebody who, given the state of human rights in Afghanistan, especially of women, who would have important things to say about that subject, because there's no other subject as pressing as human rights and the Taliban's abuses of human rights at this moment. Richard Bennett is the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Afghanistan. He's worked in many conflict zones. He's got fascinating stories to tell and very interesting insight into how the Taliban's mindset worked or works on issues related to human rights. And I hope that you will find this episode as insightful as much as I did, and I hope that you enjoy, and I hope that you keep being with us and keep listening to what we are bringing to you, and of course, send us your own story. Richard, thank you so much for joining Cobblecast. As you know, Cobblecast is a podcast that is unique and the only one of its kind that is focused on Afghanistan. So we intend to tell Afghanistan's story to the world. And I'm sure you've got plenty of stories to tell and also many important things to say about the state of affairs in Afghanistan. What I wanted to get from you first was what a lot of people will, those who are interested in what you do, and the people of Afghanistan will often see your pictures or see you on news clips or news conferences that, you know, you've put out a report or you've condemned certain things that's happened. But who is really Richard Bennett, and who's the person behind the report, and who's the person behind Richard Bennett? And I know your story goes a long way with Afghanistan. How did it begin, and how you feel about the country, and how much you know it, and I suppose how passionate you are about Afghanistan.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Roh. First of all, I'm very honored to be the inaugural guest on Cobblecast. And yeah, that's terrific. I couldn't be more chuffed than that. And it's a pleasure to meet you as well. Well, my story with Afghanistan goes back 20 years, but just, you know, maybe I'll go back a bit further than that. So I was born in the UK, and my parents emigrated to New Zealand when I was six. And I grew up in New Zealand, and I lived there till I was over 40. So I'm really a New Zealander. I carry a New Zealand passport. And I worked for the New Zealand Human Rights Commission for about 10 years. And after that, during that time, and the last part of that time, I started working more internationally. Increasingly, I got interested in international human rights, and I ended up with my first UN job in Sierra Leone in West Africa, in the middle of a conflict. It was a very brutal, horrendous conflict. And it was kind of one of the worst moments there. But I also have good memories of Sierra Leone, because it was a very religiously, I would say beyond tolerant, a religiously harmonious community. It's majority Muslim, but with also a very large Christian population. And it is so harmonious that there were jokes about some of my friends call themselves Christmas, because they would go to the mosque on a Friday and the church on a Sunday. And often the mosque and the church were adjacent, next door to each other. So that gave me the sense of the, even in a conflict, the possibility that religions can actually bring people together as well as driving them apart. And Sierra Leone has struggled economically, perhaps, but it has come out of that conflict. It had a quite successful peace process, including a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which I helped to set up, and a special court, which tried some of the most serious perpetrators of crimes, human rights violations in Sierra Leone. After that, I went to Timor-Leste, was then East Timor, and then to Afghanistan. And when I arrived in Afghanistan in 2003, almost exactly 20 years ago, June 2003, almost on the spot, my first job was as advisor to the then pretty new Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, Afghanistan. And
Which was
so,
Seema Summer, who became the head.
she was the head, and there was a number of other commissioners. They were establishing their regional offices. And so I sat with them, and so my first experience of Afghanistan was to be with Afghans every day, and also I was asked to go around the country and to visit all their provinces and their offices, and to get to know them, to make an assessment of how they were doing. So that was also good. I was with Afghans, and I got to travel around the country. It was a, ideal job to start off in Afghanistan for over a year. And then I moved to UNAMA. When I went to UNAMA, the human rights part of UNAMA was pretty small, very few staff. And then we built it up over the years, and I stayed there 3 or 4 years. I stayed 4.5 years, and then I went on to Nepal as the head of the UN Human Rights Office in Nepal, and then I went to some other countries, and I came back to Afghanistan 2014 with Amnesty International. I'd left the UN and worked for Amnesty International, and I came back a few times, 2014, 2015. And I'd seen things change, a lot more violence than in the mid 2000s. And then a bit later on, I came back in 2018. I got asked to come back to my old job, heading up the human rights section at UNAMA, which I did for about a year, 2018, 2019. And then I left. I retired, but I came back again as advising the AIHRC, which was then under Shahzad Akbar. So I worked with Seema Samar and her team, and I worked with Shahzad Akbar and her team. And that was pretty much, that was then the COVID period, so it was a bit difficult. But I did visit a few times during COVID, during the COVID time in 20, what was it, 2020, I think. And that was actually a bit of a rough time in the country. The violence was getting probably worse. There were a lot of attacks, complex attacks, in Kabul. And people were really getting afraid of these, and were also really sick of the war.
I think that there was this period where it became targeted assassinations became a thing.
Yeah, that was 2020, I think,
Yeah.
and 21, early
And
21.
we spoke before and you said you were there when the Afghan constitution were being put together.
Yeah, I
And
was. Yeah, that goes right back to 2004. And yeah, I was.
what I want to get is that how was the mood then, and how did you feel, and how the people that you're working with, especially women, and what were the, I mean, there was a lot of optimism, of course, and Afghanistan for a time was at that time the, before the Iraq War, was the center of the world in a sense. It's not an exaggeration to say that post 9/11 Afghanistan did become the center of the world. But given the history of Afghanistan and given what the people had been through and the Taliban had, you know, recently been deposed, and that sense of, you know, refound freedom, I suppose. And how did it feel? And how did you, when you reflect back, how did things play out at that time? And how, you know, how it panned out in a sense?
Well, the constitution was formulated, was debated at a constitutional lawyer jirga towards the end of 2004. And well, actually, end of 2003, I think, early 2004. And it took place in a very large tent that you may be aware of in Kabul near the Polytechnic.
Yeah.
And I went every day for 3 weeks as an observer, which was quite an experience. I saw on the first day a very brave Afghan woman stand up and challenge the male leadership in quite a famous incident, actually, in regard to the process and the content of the constitution making.
Yes, I remember that woman became an MP later. I don't remember her. I think her surname was Joya or something.
Yeah, Malalai Joya, I think.
Yes, she became an MP, and she found the kind of that brought her a sense of fame, and she was quite vocal.
It did, and I think that it's not new that Afghan women have voiced their opinions. You know, we have now in 2023, we have women protesters on the streets, but it was actually a woman who shook up the lawyer jirga in 2003, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And not because there'd been 20 years of a republic at that time, and was, you know, her mind was kind of, as some people may allege, kind of filled with Western ideas. Not at all. There is a long and proud tradition of Afghan women protest and standing up. In fact, there was, I think, in the 90s, a well-known radical women's group called RAW, Radical
Rawa.
Afghan Women. Rawa, yeah, Rawa. Yeah. Radical Women of Afghanistan.
I think the founder was Malala. She was assassinated in Peshawar somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is a deep history, I think, of women's activism in Afghanistan. It's not something that's happened in the last 2 years or so since the Taliban took over. It goes back a long way, and in fact, goes back to, even I'd say, the end of the 19th century, and I'm not a historian of Afghanistan particularly, but there were movements back then. People might be surprised to learn that Afghan women, that suffrage was given to Afghan women in 1919. That was pretty early. Mm-hmm. And in 1923, Afghanistan got its first modern constitution. Which gave women a lot of rights, actually.
But we are here now, and so what is your assessment? I think in one of your recent reports, and it has been said by others as well, G7 foreign ministers and Antony Blinken as well, I think, said some of the things that the Taliban have been doing, and I think you alluded to in recent report as well, what the Taliban have been doing in recent months, or since returning to power, may amount to crime against humanity. I mean, this is quite strong word.
Yeah, I have used that word. In particular, I used it relation to attacks on religious minorities and mm-hmm. ethnic minorities, including particularly Hazara, because of the number, the systematic pattern of attacks. I didn't actually say, though, that it was the Taliban who was responsible for those, because, as you know, mm-hmm. ISKP, also known as Daesh, has taken responsibility for many of those. But what I did say, and will continue to say, is that Although certainly not recognized as a government, the Taliban hold a power and have a responsibility to protect the population, and that means all members of the population. And the human rights treaties that Afghanistan has signed up to over the years still apply in Afghanistan because they apply to the state. They don't apply to any particular government. So those are responsibilities that apply. And of course, also international humanitarian law applies appropriately in Afghanistan.
And do you sense in your dealings with the Taliban that they understand, or do they feel the inheritors of the Afghan state and with all the obligations that it's signed up to? Do you feel that they sense that? And also, if they do, what is it that's driving them to so systematically persecute women and girls?
That's a big question. I mean, I think it's probably well known to most of the listeners of Kabulcast that Afghanistan in Afghanistan, women and girls are discriminated against in a systematic fashion more than any other country in the world. There's also a lot of violence still in Afghanistan. The Taliban are ruling by fear. So they have, I think one way to look at it is that they claim to be instituting a pure Islamic state and ruling according to Islamic Sharia. However, the way they interpret doing that is not shared by any other Muslim state. Nevertheless, the Taliban feel that they're right. And so when you've got an ideological group that's not willing to listen to others, even others within the same religious milieu, you get extremism. And they are ruling autocratically. They are ruling with violence, with the gun, and with creating a huge sense of fear. They claim that they're on a purification campaign, that the country as a whole was impure. It was polluted by the Republic, which was a puppet of the West, and that they are basically cleaning it up and finishing the job that they started it between 1996
And
and
why do
2001.
you think that cleanup, in their sense, must begin with girls being deprived of going to school or women being able to work, in the most mundane jobs that they have had? And also, they've got a peculiar way of saying we respect certain things within the confines of Sharia, and then add another clause, Afghan culture. And you sense, what do they mean? I mean, they qualify everything when it comes to whether it's women's rights, human rights, or anything to do with people's rights and their behavior as a responsible actor. They always qualify it, we do certain things based on Islam, and then quickly qualify it, our Afghan culture. What do you think of Afghan culture and tradition? What is your sense? I mean, you deal with them often, you condemn them. And often, and what is your sense of what do they mean? I mean, is there any clarity in their understanding of, yeah, we mean this by Sharia and we mean this Afghan tradition?
I think there's always a qualification. Even when I talk to them about human rights and about their responsibilities under international law, they tend to agree. They say, yes, we will abide by those standards, provided they are compatible with Sharia and Afghan tradition. So it's a qualification. It's a caveat, and they don't describe what they mean. So you never know. It can be used as an excuse, it seems. And it's true that they
And
also
do you think, sorry, do you think that is on purpose? Do you think that they have practiced it so much that they know what it means, or it's a gateway out of a conundrum that they find themselves in? And also, do you think they recognize that Afghanistan is a multi-ethnic country? And of course, traditions mean different things to different people. If you look, you know, you've well traveled enough. If you go to Bamiyan, for example, tradition there does not match to what it is in Helmand or in Mazar-e-Sharif. So how do they, you know, understand, or is it just their rigid way of what they have as a concept of Afghan tradition coupled
My
with
own view
Sharia?
Is that it's rigid and ideological, and that is used in order to exercise power and control, because there is no tolerance for dissent, and there is very little tolerance for even difference, let alone defense, but just difference. And you, as you pointed out, Afghanistan is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country with many different traditions. But when I've discussed that with the Taliban, they do say that they recognize all the different groups, but they prefer to talk about Afghan. In other words, to talk about Afghan not as multi-ethnic or a country. One thing that's very sensitive is to call Afghanistan a country of minorities. Some people say it's a country of minorities, and others find that a very...
and of course, the word, the concept of who's an Afghan has become contentious in itself.
Yeah.
You know, more so in recent years. So as you'd understand, you know, other people in Afghanistan might, as I was in a village in Afghanistan, we would call the Pashtuns Afghan. But that has, for, you know, identity politics or whatever you put into, has become a contentious issue. As you remember, the ID card became such a contentious issue as well.
Yeah.
And going to, you know, as you've lined up, and, you know, where there rarely a day without some sort of, you know, human rights abuses committed by the Taliban. And the most recent one, the, you know, day before yesterday, you were part of the, you know, group of UN experts who condemned the Taliban's use of corporal punishments. And day by day, when you go about your job, how is it, you know, how do you keep things in check, and how do you try to keep Afghanistan relevant to, given all the conflicts around the world, and you've got, you know, a wealth of experience working in conflict areas, but given Afghanistan's place and given how quickly everything crumbled, it's as if the foundations of that state was built on sand and it just crumbled away, and everything that had come with it. And how do you keep Afghanistan? I mean, for it's easy for people in the West to wash their hands off, as, you know, it is something that's happening far away and we're not really interested because it brings us so much bad memories. But how, as in your job, do you and other organizations that you work with try to keep Afghanistan A, relevant, and B, keep it in public consciousness?
I mean, to start with, yes, I do point out with other colleagues the human rights violations that are continuing in Afghanistan. We've talked about the widespread and systematic discrimination against women. But you're right, the statement we made a day or two ago was about the use of corporal capital punishment, stoning, and flogging, essentially. Noting that these punishments are contrary to international human rights standards that Afghanistan has agreed to. I'm not a UN staff member, actually. These posts as special rapporteurs are pro bono, but we are elected by the member states at the Human Rights Council, and they want eyes and ears. And they want a voice. And so my role is to document, to collect information, to assess it, to make reports on it, to speak about it, about the situation, to shine a light on the situation in Afghanistan. And, you know, why should anyone care? Well, after 9/11, there was a huge intervention in Afghanistan. That was partly due to 9/11, although I note that not a single one of the 9/11 suspects was Afghan. Bin Laden was hosted in Afghanistan at the time and was given sanctuary in Afghanistan at the time. The Taliban were driven out, and there was a massive military and humanitarian and development and human rights intervention in the country for a long time. Many Afghans welcomed that, some did not.
Do you fear, given the state of affairs now, Afghanistan's beginning or is turning into another safe haven for terrorism, as it's been said before by, other countries, for example, the US and others, the reports coming out saying Afghanistan, the security, global security is a concern when it comes to Afghanistan. And how do you see that playing out?
I think there are certainly reports of that by different agencies, including Times, the Security Council, and other UN agencies. It's not something that I monitor. I monitor human rights, and the situation has deteriorated greatly. I do want to say, though, that human rights situation was never perfect in Afghanistan. If anyone kind of feels that there was a golden age of 20 years, and then it's been turned upside down in a day by the Taliban. Yes, there has been a very significant deterioration, and the situation is very, very grave. But it was never perfect, and human rights violations continued to be committed before the Republic and during the Republic. Now, after the Republic, and to go back to why should people care? Well, lots of reasons, really. The intervention was also seen in part to liberate Afghan women who had been under the yoke, the discrimination of the Taliban between 96 and 2001, where and they're back, they're pretty much back in the same place now. And Afghans, many Afghans feel very let down. They feel very abandoned and ignored by countries who made promises to support them and said that they would not leave them exposed again. And yet they did so. And so there is not a peace agreement in Afghanistan. There was a Doha agreement between the US and the Taliban. No others signed up to that agreement, no countries, and including not Afghanistan as a government. There were some subsequent peace talks, which were part of the Doha agreement, but those talks collapsed, and the Taliban took power by force, but in fact, it was, as you've said earlier, like a house of cards. The whole country collapsed in not much more than 10 days. And I think that is kind of a significant issue because I think the Taliban were perhaps as surprised as everyone else that they so easily and so rapidly took over the country. Most of the predictions were that eventually the Taliban would take power, but perhaps through some kind of power sharing or political settlement. But as it happened very rapidly. And I think they were surprised and they were in a state of shock, and to some degree still are. And probably, on one hand, are they running a state or are they still fighting a jihad? I'm not sure they've really resolved that because even from the statements of their leader, it appears that they are still in the jihad mode a lot of the time. But at the same time, they want to be recognized as a legitimate government. And in my view, have not done anywhere near enough to warrant that kind of legitimization. In fact, they have not kept any or very few of their promises, especially on human rights and on the rights of women, rights of minorities.
For a lot of people in Afghanistan, I think there's a disconnect or Even when the talks, when the Doha meeting, the news came about, it became quite controversial about the possibility of Doha becoming a venue again. Once it became a venue for handing in power, the other time it's becoming a UN-hosted meeting, becoming a venue for them to be granted recognition, or the possibility of the discussion of them achieving some sort of recognition became so contentious, which made human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, of course, many people from inside in Afghanistan condemn the mere mention of Taliban recognition in the same sense. And what is your sense? And I think that turned into the frustration that people have with the UN in Afghanistan, outside Afghanistan, given that a lot of people especially have criticized UNAMA for not being vocal enough and not being stringent enough.
I mean, first of all, I think the Doha meeting was built up in advance to be something that it was never going to be. It was my understanding, and I didn't attend, was that it was conceived to be a get together in private of special envoys in the hope that they may kind of develop policy in common over time, probably not at one meeting. And then somehow this issue of recognition crept in for various reasons, with statements by that were not intended to be related to the Doha meeting by, and you mentioned Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed. There were other statements as well, and I think it created a huge amount of concern about recognition, and I've made my position clear about that matter. In terms of UNAMA, I don't really want to comment except to say that sometimes I feel that they have been fairly clear, and I think they haven't been always fairly reported. At the same time as the Doha thing came up, there was the banning by the Taliban of women working in the UN, which followed on the banning of women working for NGOs. And I think that's a very serious matter. And I do, it's a clear violation of the UN Charter to tell the UN who they can employ or not. And it's a violation of human rights principles, of equality, of employment
I
on
do think
any
because
grounds.
of that, the UN finds itself in a hard and rock place, or is it rock and hard place? To in one hand, Afghanistan's got 28 million peoples in need of humanitarian aid to survive, and on the other hand, the Taliban is making it more and more difficult for them to operate.
I
And
think, yeah.
as somebody who've been working in Afghanistan for a long time, what do you think the Taliban leadership, given the state of the country, why would they want to make things more difficult for the people?
I mean, you need to ask the Taliban that. I do think the UN is in a difficult place, but I would say that the crisis in Afghanistan is a humanitarian, human rights, and political crisis. And at times, I think, and the UN works in difficult places. It doesn't really deploy in large numbers, except in countries which are difficult. It comes with the territory. Think of many other countries where the UN is involved, Somalia, Ethiopia, DRC and Mali and Haiti, many other countries. They're not easy. None of these are easy situations. And it's the job of the UN to apply the principles that have been agreed by member states over decades to these hard choices. They are not easy choices, but they need the application in a very careful, systematic way of both human rights principles and humanitarian principles. And in no way, in my view, should half the population be discriminated against. That is not acceptable. It could be a different group. It might not be women that were told not to come to work. What if it was Hazaras that were told not to come to work, or Tajiks that were not told not to come to work? That would be unacceptable as well. The principle of equality and inclusiveness must be central. And if there are to be any measures taken, human rights, they need to be human rights based, and they need to always be working towards moving back to a situation of respect for human rights, even though it might be hard and it might take some time.
And what is your, you mentioned the ethnic dimension of human rights abuses. We're not just talking about ISKP attacking, Hazara tuition center. We have had, in your own reports, Hazaras being systematically abused by the Taliban themselves, as have been done in the past. And of course, we've had in northwestern Afghanistan, where Uzbeks in villages have been complaining about being forcibly displaced. And of course, you've had stories of Panjshir, where civilians have been, pushed out of their homes. And the same thing happened in Dainkundi and other places as well. And how do you ensure that those are as documented and as spoken as become something to be attended to, as well as, the attention grabbing, not that in any way I'm discounting the state of, abuses that's committed on women. So how do you, as a, do you have to separate based on the types of abuses, or you just have to look at holistically, say there's a mass violation of human rights in Afghanistan?
I think we need to remember that that human rights are universal. They're interdependent and they're indivisible. We shouldn't have any kind of hierarchy of human rights, and so one can't look the other way with any human rights abuses. And I have included in my reports concern about discrimination against Hazara and against other ethnic and religious communities, and not only the attacks on mosques and schools and other public places, which have resulted in mass atrocities, but also the perhaps more kind of insidious but nevertheless very destructive discrimination. You mentioned forced displacement in Dainkundi, for example, and also in the northwest in Uzbek areas. There's also an issue, other issues of removal of minorities from public office, which has been a great concern. People basically losing their jobs. Allegedly, because of their ethnicity, having a huge economic impact, losing the possibility of genuine political participation, certainly because they're women, but also at times because of their other identities that they may have. And there are many intersectional issues that some suffer, particularly women who might also be a member of a minority group. So yeah, the problem goes. I don't want to in any way underestimate the seriousness of mass attacks, but the problem goes much deeper than that. I could go on and mention taxation issues as well, which has been a concern, particularly for Hazara. But lack of political participation, lack of economic participation, very, very serious issues. And I think what I'd like to say is that what's been created is a very polarized environment. And a polarized environment is not a healthy environment. It's not an environment that can lead to a stable and inclusive society. The Taliban claim that they brought security. They have not reduced tensions. Tensions continue to escalate. While there is this kind of exclusion, a feeling of being sidelined, being discriminated against, the country becomes more polarized, and I fear for the future partly for that reason. And it's critical, in my view, that some middle ground is found. You mentioned earlier in our conversation that people used to call themselves Afghans, and now identity is more complicated. People will call themselves often by their ethnic group. They'll say they're maybe Tajik, or they're from Panjshiri. If they're from Panjshir, maybe geographical, or they're Hazara, or they're Uzbek. And is that a good thing? You know, what keeps a country together? What is the glue that keeps a country from falling apart? What is in common? And it's, I think, you know, for Afghans, and I know many do, think deeply about these issues of identity and the glue that keeps Afghanistan as a country together. And that, I think, is essential if there is to be, I mean, after 45 years of conflict, if this has been to be brought to a close, it requires a sense of commonality, a sense of honesty. And I think in that, you know, when we talk about justice, it also means that the truth needs to come out. And I think there, the international community also has an important role to play, because the international community is not innocent of having committed atrocities against Afghans either. We know that this was done by a number of countries. A few are taking actions to hold those responsible to account for their ill treatment, their mistreatment of Afghans. And I think there's no room for double standards. And I noted earlier that you know, while I do condemn the Taliban, I don't think that human rights violations started in August 2021. We need to have a sense of history and go back and to look at all parties and their responsibilities. And that process needs to be broad and pluralistic, to take responsibility for the situation in which Afghanistan finds itself now, and as I said, a humanitarian, human rights, and political crisis.
And do you think you mentioned your fear about the future of Afghanistan, and do you feel, and you also mentioned that the among your fears, if there is going to be a country left to govern, and do you think that the trajectory, if the Taliban continue this path, do you feel that what do you see the prospect of Afghanistan? Is it sustainable as it is as a country, given the state of affairs as now and the way the Taliban are ruling it?
Yeah, I mean, how many governments has Afghanistan had in the last century, and how many times has a power been transferred from one government to another? I think there's been, you know, about 13 or 14 different governments, and only once has transfer has there been a peaceful transfer of power. And the average length of time for an administration, I think, is about 6 or 7 years. The Republic lasted 20 years. So, you know, how to break this cycle of violence and of misrule as well. You know, there are genuine concerns about the misrule and corruption in the past. Now there are genuine concerns about autocratic regime that is ruling with accepting no dissent and ruling with violence and with no constitution. A very a confusing situation about what law applies, where the institutions that are basic to a well-governed country, such as a parliament, an independent judiciary, are not present. So, yes, there may be a period now, but I do think that it's important for all parties, and I'm not making any judgments about this, I'm saying just important for there to be a strategic approach to the future that preserves the dignity and the rights of Afghans, and that human rights is not a threat in this respect. Some people might see sometimes it's a threat. Human rights is part of the solution, because the reason we have a Universal Declaration of Human Rights came out of the Second World War. It's a few years after the Second World War. It was part of the effort to ensure never again should the atrocities that took place in the Second World War reoccur. And human rights should be seen as a friend, as a tool that can be used at every level.
I'm sure you make those arguments to, you know, Taliban officials when you meet them. And how do they react? You know, you make these arguments about human rights as your friend, not your enemy. If you want to rule longer, you should need to, you know, respect this.
I do. I have made those. And I think that their view is often to not to reject human rights outright, but again, to overlay it with what you said earlier, the view that the fundamental principle is Islam, Sharia, and that human rights are acceptable only when they do not conflict with Sharia or Afghan tradition. So I think this conversation needs to be taken further. I've asked, so how much of human rights is in conflict with Sharia? And the response has been, well, not much. And when I say, well, how much? Well, you know, very little, 10% maybe. So let's discuss that 10%. And that, I think, is where the work needs to be done.
And of course, at Kabulcast, we're also interested in stories. You know, you've had a long history in Afghanistan, working there and meeting a lot of people. And when you look at the highlights of your work in Afghanistan, you know, what are the stories that really comes to your mind and makes you, you know, the happiest moments of your work in Afghanistan? Also, you know, mundane stories. Kabulcast is about telling Afghanistan's story to the world. It's not all about politics and, you know, official meetings. It's also about Kabul. And people often refer to Kabul as Kabul John, as if, you know, it's got some sort of a life of its own that is, you know, that is something to love. It's the beloved, Kabul the beloved, I suppose. I can translate it as. And when I went there, you know, as you get off the plane and the first whiff that comes into your face is the smog, the heavy smell of smog and the burned tires. But in there's something in that air that grips you. And what is, you know, your sense of Kabul John, and what does Kabul John mean to you?
What it means is that one of the first things that comes through to me is the sense of hospitality that Afghans have, and it doesn't matter which group of Afghans you're from. I mean, if we're talking about Afghan tradition, hospitality is one to guests is one of those traditions, and that resonates with me because I grew up in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And the Maori tradition is very similar, in my opinion. It's that if you are welcomed onto somebody's land, mm-hmm. as an outsider, we have ceremonies in New Zealand that involve singing, that involve mixing of breath. You may have seen the rubbing of noses. And you go through that ceremony, and then after that, you're no longer an outsider. Mm-hmm. You're one of us.
Yeah.
And I think there's a bit of a sense of that in Kabul, that if you're Kabuli, you are accepted as someone who's respected and will protect you.
Mm-hmm.
I have not met a more hospitable culture, people, or peoples, plural, than Afghan, who will take you into their homes, offer you tea, offer you masses of food, even though they may be quite poor people, and who create a sense of of belonging and protection. And I think that's something that Kabul means to me, and amazingly proud of everything that's Afghan, not only the beautiful scenery of Afghanistan, and I can see the picture of Bamiyan behind you, but the beautiful, rich culture, the music, the poetry of Afghanistan. It's a wonderfully rich civilization. The artifacts, the things that are in the museum, but the things that are in the shops in Flower Street and Chicken Street are also things that that I would cherish. They're made by artists and artisans. The carpets and the pots and the Herati glass and the jewelry, the lapis, you know, is all something that makes this a very, very special environment.
Thank you so much, Richard. And let's end this inaugural episode, I suppose, with, you know, we covered a lot of subjects, most of it really grim. But towards the end, we've come to realize and to appreciate Kabul and Kabul John. But let's end it with an anecdote that really cheers you up. So to cheer our listeners up, so they can tune in again and again and again about somewhere outside Kabul. You know, you've got on my background, you've got Bamiyan, and maybe we should just end it with an anecdote of you telling us a story about Bamiyan. And you know, how did you find that void that is, again, we're just turning into the grim part of that void that's left behind. And I think, you know, Taliban will be gone sometime in the future, sooner or later, they'll become history. But I think what the void that they left behind will be permanent for eternity, for as long as that mountain stands. But let's park that aside and just end it with something positive that brings Bamiyan to you.
Well, I mean, it of course, you know, I can see in the picture of Bamiyan behind you the massive gap in the cliff where the Buddha used to stand. So that's not very positive. But I will. Well, I think that anecdote I'll tell you is that your listeners may know that around an hour's drive from Bamiyan is Bandi Amir. And these are the most beautiful turquoise-colored lakes in the middle of a desert, in a kind of a mountain desert. And then you come across these absolutely stunning lakes. And I visited them a few times. I've been lucky to be able to do that.
And did you swim in there?
Yes, I swam in the lakes. I jumped in. I've jumped in a few times. And the last time I went was during COVID, 2020, mm-hmm. September. And we spent a whole day there. I was actually at a workshop in Bamiyan, you know, kind of a serious workshop. And we took a day off.
Okay.
Pretend it was part of the workshop. We all got in the cars and we went to Bani Amir. And there's these little plastic boats. I don't know if you've seen those.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures. I've not been there.
So we went out on the lake in these little boats for, you know, a few hours and then had a picnic on the side of the lake. And that's such a lovely memory. I think I was probably the only non-Afghan there. There were men and women. We just had a great time in this stunning environment and with wonderful company and fantastic picnic food. I didn't talk about Afghan food, amongst the other things that people may not be so familiar with, but Afghan food of many different kinds. But if you're eating outside in a picnic, and you know, people in Britain and other countries will be familiar with the barbecue. Well, Afghans are probably the best at doing that in terms of cooking, and if you're a meat eater, especially. And I remember having wonderful times. In Bamiyan and in Bandi Amir not so long ago, and I do hope that those times will come back again.
Thank you so much.